Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the co-author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now conducted over 100 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by Peter Russell, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation entitled, Supposing It's Too Late, What Then? The way this will work is I'll introduce Peter and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions. And we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Peter Russell studied mathematics and theoretical physics at Cambridge University. As he became increasingly fascinated by the mysteries of the human mind, he changed to experimental psychology and traveled to India to study meditation and Eastern philosophy. He also has a postgraduate degree in computer science. In the 1970s, he was one of the first people to introduce human potential seminars into the corporate field, and for 20 years ran programs for senior management on creativity, stress management, personal development, and sustainable development. As one of the more revolutionary futurists, Peter has been a keynote speaker at many international conferences in Europe, Japan, and the USA. In 1982, he coined the term global brain with his 1980s bestseller of the same name, in which he predicted the Internet and the impact it would have. His other books include The TM Technique, The Upanishads, The Brain Book, The Creative Manager, The Consciousness Revolution, Waking Up in Time, and his most recent, From Science to God. His principal interest is the deeper spiritual significance of the times we are passing through. What I especially appreciate about Peter is his combination of penetrating intelligence, discernment, and spiritual depth. He's been at the forefront of enlightened futurism for over three decades, focusing on the big questions, the things that I think really matter most. And he continues to dare to push into unexplored territory with discriminating intelligence and sincere, sustained care. I especially appreciate him as a brilliant thinking partner and conversation partner. He's someone who is genuinely willing to have a real conversation in a way that allows it to move into genuinely new territory and not just unfurl a series of monologues. He's expanded my own feeling contemplation of our evolutionary emergency, even as he has challenged me. So that's why I invited him to have this public dialogue and why I'm excited to share this with all of you. So welcome, Peter. Thanks so much for being here with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Terry. It's good to be here.
Well, terrific. Now, you've been contemplating the unique nature of our current moment in evolution for a long time, and it might be good if at the outset you can say something to help any listeners unfamiliar with your work understand what exactly it is about these big questions that has captured your imagination and where you've seen an opportunity to make your own contribution.
Yes. I think all along behind my work, going way back, probably 40 years, it really, when I was in India, things began to shift for me. I think two things happened then which have been sort of pivotal for the rest of my work in over the years. One was seeing that there was something to spirituality. I'd rejected religion as a kid as a load of sort of ancient mumbo-jumbo of no relevance whatsoever to the contemporary world. And then realizing, hang on, there was something to all the great spiritual traditions. It may have got lost in translation, lost in being absorbed by the culture, being misunderstood. But I thought underneath they were all pointing towards the same thing, and that was that we work from a very limited view of the world. We are stuck in a sort of egocentric, materialistic, me first, what can I get view of the world. And that lies behind many of our problems, personal, social, global, environmental, whatever, that this mode of thinking, this mode of consciousness, and that all traditions, in one way or another, sought to free people from that limited mode of thinking. And so part of my work has been really trying to come down to the essence of that, trying to distill the teachings down to what is that essence that made them all once alive and fired people with enthusiasm. What was that essence? And at the same time, seeing that we in the world are just faced with an increasing number of problems. Everywhere we look, we're seeing crises manifesting in one way or another, and they're all interconnected as well. They're not just out there on their own. The crisis is interconnected in what the Club of Rome called this global problematique. And I began to see that, you know, behind all these problems, again, was this question of human thinking, human values, what's important to us, and realizing that what we tend to do when we're faced with a problem is we go and tackle the problem itself. We see something that's wrong, we introduce new legislation or something, or we see, you know, we're getting rid of the rainforest, chopping down the rainforest, whatever, say, okay, we've got to stop that. We're fighting the whole time the symptoms of a deeper problem. That deeper problem is our consciousness, that we are caught in a mode of consciousness that may have been very good in our ancient past and, you know, appropriate at times in our own lives, but most of the time it's just not only holding us back and causing us to suffer as individuals, it's actually the root of what's going on in the world. So I would say my work over the years has been this thing of trying to distill and share what I see as the essence of spiritual work and make it available as widely as possible. Because I think, you know, as you feel yourself, this is what we need in the world today. This is the root cause. And as well as tackling the symptoms, we need to come back and actually look at what is the root of our problem here.
Mm. And yet, as a futurist, you who recognizes and forefronts the importance of these deep principles about consciousness, you've also worked in the belly of the beast as a consultant to major corporations. And one aspect of what you've done that is part of what was the springboard for our decision to create this public dialogue is what you learned by doing formal scenario planning. It might be good if you could fill us in a little bit about that.
Yes, yes. This goes back about 20 years. I was working with Shell Oil. And they are an interesting company in that they probably look further ahead into the future on a systematic basis than any other corporation. And so they have this scenario planning unit. In fact, it isn't a sort of fixed unit. Each year they reform it, they take on new people, new consultants, and they sit down for 3 years to look basically 25, 30 years ahead at what is the world going to be like, what, and the different possibilities. So they're looking at scenarios, and the whole purpose of scenarios is not to predict the future, but to say, well, if it unfolded this way, how would it look? Or if it unfolded this way, how would it look? And so for a company like Shell, they're saying, you know, we're thinking of building a new refinery in Venezuela or something. How does it look under this scenario? How does it look under this scenario? And so you only go ahead and do something if it looks like it's going to work out under all scenarios. If you see one scenario where it doesn't make sense, then that says maybe we shouldn't do this. So it's really sort of covering your bases in making long-term decisions. And when I was working with them, I was just working on one of these cycles. We had two scenarios we were presenting to the board. We just called them A and B. And at that time, it was actually looking at the long-term fallout of the whole collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Iron Curtain and that stuff. We're looking at how would that pan out in the world. And in our discussions, we realized there was what we called scenario X, which was under the table, which was no point in presenting to the board, but we all sort of felt it was there, and that was maybe it's just too late that we actually, the unraveling of our civilization is underway, and whatever we do, we're going to be ending up in dire straits in 20, 30 years' time. And obviously that's not something that the board of Shell wants to take into their thinking. They're looking at, you know, realistic alternatives that actually, in which Shell oil has a future. So, you know, we all agreed that was there, but we didn't, you know, we weren't going to present it to the board. And then a few years later, I realized I was actually not looking at this scenario either in myself. I was in a level of denial here or refusing to go there. And I sat down one day and was thinking, okay, here am I. I was, at this time I was traveling around. I was promoting my book, The White Hole in Time. And I was saying, you know, the root of our problem is our consciousness, and if we can just change our consciousness, move into a new consciousness, things will be okay again. And I was thinking, well, you know, let me look at this seriously. Here am I, somebody who most of my life I've been interested in my own inner awakening. Am I a paradigm of awakened enlightenment? No way. I have still a lot of, a long way to go, a lot of stuff to work on. And what about, you know, the other 99% of the world who aren't even interested in this? Like, how real is this, what I'm saying? How likely is this to really happen? And so I started saying, well, what if it is too late? What then? And I started looking at how the world would be in terms of what would be coming down, what would be facing us in terms of basically on a human level of adjustment, pain, suffering, but also new opportunities. And just thinking, what would we need at that stage? And I realized what we would need is things like deeper community, more flexibility in our thinking, creativity, greater compassion, care for each other, and also being able to be more stable in ourselves, more secure in ourselves. And as I looked at these things, I realized this was exactly the same need as what I've been talking about in terms of the way saving the world. So whether we were saving the world or accepting that maybe it was too late, what it came down to in terms of our own spiritual work and how we work in community was exactly the same. And that was a moment of, it was a sort of an epiphany for me. It was a moment of freedom as well, in which I realized the work I wanted to do was important anyway, whatever the scenario. And I said it gave me a sense of freedom, which has really been there ever since. The work is still the same, but there's less attachment to it's got to be this for this reason or it's got to be done for this reason. It's just the work needs to be done anyway.
Yeah. You know, I had a similar moment at a certain point in my process about 12 years ago. I was researching these same issues and in a way just daring to look at the implications of global warming, of loose nukes in a terrorist-filled world, of a variety of really horrific dynamics, and not just global warming, but the general degradation of the environment, the acidification of the oceans, all kinds of things with really huge consequences. And I realized that emotionally, I didn't want to commit to the good work with the fullness of my whole existential heart and soul unless I had some way to see daylight, that we could make it through, and then I would be committed to this course of action. And I realized how cowardly that was, that I actually was it was as if I wanted to lay odds on the horse race between consciousness and catastrophe and feel we had a fighting chance, and then I could commit. Whereas, in fact, the reality would be, no matter what, I would want to go down. I would want to, if I was to be killed by some natural catastrophe in the process, or my even the quality of my life was to be degraded, even if I was to suffer in some really intense way, I would want to be embodying my values and my character. I would want to be doing the thing that could have turned things around if they could have been turned around. And that was a huge liberation for me psychically. I saw that, oh, wait a second, I don't need to lay odds. What I can simply do is make an unqualified, wholehearted commitment to live my values, to be the thing that can be turning all of this around, if indeed it can be. And that's the same thing that would express my values and my character under the worst case scenario. And that's been a very liberating shift for me. And yet I have to say, I've pretty much fixed my attention on turning things around, not on contemplating scenario X. And it's been powerful recently to talk with you, you know, about the existential and spiritual and emotional and psychic implications of scenario X, which I know you've been willing to take to heart in a way others, you know, have not. I think many of us feel this instinctive sense that our positive energy toward the best possible outcomes is the source of our best creativity. And so it feels like it's a moral imperative to be optimistic. If we engage and we feel as though maybe it's all going to go to hell in a handbasket anyway, then we won't be able to commit our best energy and our best creativity and our best efforts. If we feel like this is really perhaps all is lost, we won't really show up fully. And that isn't necessarily so. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk about why this has been such a fruitful consideration for you.
Yes, I've been faced with this question myself over the years. I've spoken a lot and agree with you that there's something about being positive, maintaining a positive attitude. There's so much evidence that actually helps us, that it actually furthers what we're doing. And that's been part of my work, is maintaining that, and yet also important to be honest to my own truth as well, how I see it, and not to push away in doing that, not to push away the fact that, you know, there's a lot of point of saying, you know, we may not be here in 100 years if we're not careful. That's, you know, particularly even just, you know, looking at climate change or something, it's like there's so much action that needs to go into trying to control it or even possibly reverse it. And that's really valuable. And I think in the role of activism, for activists, that positive attitude is really important. But I couldn't sit with myself knowing that I could also see clearly scenarios in which, you know, as the title of this program says, it was too late. And so just looking at those, I felt, as I say, this sense we both said of there being a greater freedom in terms of letting go of this holding on to things. I think there's a parallel here with our own mortality, that we know we are mortal beings, that we are going to die at some stage. And that is probably, you know, the great certainty of our individual lives. And yet most of us live our lives almost as if it's not going to happen. It's like, oh, yes, that's going to happen sometime, but yeah, I'm not bothered about it. I'm not going to think about it. And yet what all the great spiritual traditions, or most of them, point to is there is value and liberation in actually that real acceptance of one's own mortality. And I think it's something we also see in life when people are faced with their own mortality, whether it's suddenly being in a situation where they could suddenly die or having some terminal disease or something, that can become a transforming point for them. They can actually somehow let go of that holding on, I've got to, you know, I'm living life so that I can do this, get this, be somewhere, achieve this. Suddenly, when you're faced with your own mortality, that somehow fades, and there's what there normally is not normally, but there's a general pattern of an opening of the heart, an opening of compassion and of wisdom and seeing what's important. And the same thing when people actually have near-death experiences, what they come back with time and time again is wanting to care for humanity, wanting to do something useful. There's a sense of wanting to express love in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder whether the same is true in facing the possibility of our own species mortality, in really facing that honestly and truly, whether there can actually be in that an opening of the heart, an opening of greater compassion, not just for those around us, but also for our species as a whole. I think this is one thing it's led to for me is I don't blame anybody for where we are. I mean, you said earlier, you know, I was working in the belly of the beast. I never saw it as the beast, the corporate world. It's just the people there were just people working to, you know, keep their kids in school, pay their mortgages, whatever. It's just it's part of the system. I don't think there's anywhere we actually went wrong. I have a lot more compassion for the evolution of our culture, how it's happened and how we're in this situation. And that's also been important for me. I don't blame people. I don't get upset at the latest, you know, political, whatever it is, goings on or some corruption scandal or something. There's a way of just accepting that this is how we are. And we're all part of this system. I mean, we talk about climate change. I mean, it's like, we're all part of a system of consuming oil. You know, I know some people, perhaps they don't have cars or whatever, but nevertheless, we're part of this system. So it's led to, yes, I think it has led to a greater compassion. And this thing of not blaming people. They're the people at fault. They're the people who've gone wrong. And it's not to say we've all gone wrong. I don't think either. So I think, you know, really, I think we've always made the decisions that we thought were best, given our limited knowledge, our limited understanding, our own psychological stuff that was going on. Nevertheless, I think in one way or another, we've striven for the best, and it hasn't always turned out that way. But I don't blame anybody. I think that's been the big shift for me.
Well, there's so much in this conversation that bears upon our deepening as conscious, caring participants in our lives and in our world. One piece that I want to bring forward is that I think that for many people, the potential for perhaps human extinction at the worst case, but even crossing a point of no return that would plunge us into some sort of a dystopian Mad Max kind of a, you know, horrible world, you know, The Road or Water World, one of these images of a degradation of the human species, you know, the thought that we might be headed to some sort of a horror is so disturbing, you know, because I think we derive a lot of meaning in our lives from the sense that we're contributing to something that has a hopeful outcome even beyond our lifetimes, that the songs we compose and sing, that the books we write, that the lives we touch will go on after we're gone to somehow bloom again in some new possibility. And it's really through our relationship with the larger species that our individual lives seem to have a lot of their meaning. And when I imagine that context could be removed, I feel just a horrible sense of loss, of being even a tinier speck in a great big vast, you know, cosmic context that emphasizes my insignificance, you know, in an almost existentially disorienting way. For me, what arises is I find myself thinking of a wonderful book by the Jungian psychologist James Hillman called The Force of Character, which he wrote very close to the end of his life, about the last years of his life, when the purpose of his life was not to establish his work or do his career, or it was in a way, as he put it, to simply express his character more fully. That he was putting the finishing touches on the masterpiece that was his character in his life, and that this is the meaning of the end of life. When someone's in their 80s or 90s, what's the purpose of their life? It's, in a sense, just to simply express their values and character. And I find myself thinking that, well, if we are among the last generations of human beings, does it become even more important then to be all that a human being can be, to express the character of our species, the highest character of our species, not so that it goes on, but just so that it gets done, so that the beauty and nobility of this amazing human experiment express itself in the most beautiful and spiritually fragrant way it possibly can.
Yes, I'm feeling that for myself. I suppose in my own life, my own what I write these days, like, what have I really want to say? What's it been about? Where am I? And just what is my truth? What have I found to be true? And just to share that, however things are going to work out. And I mean, one thing just to mention, I think you were touching on it before, is, you know, when we, you know, even to consider these, you know, dystopian futures is really, really difficult. I mean, I can look at things on paper and look at, you know, okay, what's going to happen on paper if, you know, temperature rises 4 degrees and we have, you know, the whole of Antarctica melts, we have this flooding and we have this and we have refugee problems and we have, you know, food problems and this and that. And, you know, I can see how it all lays out on paper of what could happen with uncontrolled climate change. But what I find really difficult is to actually go there in my, you know, in my heart, to actually go there and to really entertain how it's going to be. It's like I'm still caught in the sort of this nice, you know, rather rosy life we're living here. And it's just emotionally very, very hard to go there. And yet I think it is important to actually to let that in, to let that pain in. And, you know, to be honest, I don't know how to do that fully myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I feel that what has happened for me in my practice is that the great traditions, all of the practices that have come to us from these thousands of years of wisdom evolving and now in conversation with one another, the practices that I've learned have had to become an ongoing action inquiry, my practice has to be alive and it has to keep evolving, and this contemplation is like so many things. I've often brought forward the idea that our crisis is a koan, an impossible question, a riddle that stretches our consciousness and draws us to become deeper beings. And I think that that there's a kind of sobriety. Samuel Johnson is often quoted as saying that there's nothing like the prospect of an imminent hanging to clear the mind. And there's something about our denial, our psychic inability, and in many cases refusal to look at the worst case scenario, that may be rendering our way of being a little superficial. Like, to the degree mm-hmm. that my contemplation is rooted in that denial, am I really standing on bedrock, you know, or am I a little bit playing a game with that's, you know, made superficial by my own fear? And mm-hmm. so I think that this koan is served by our having the courage to face what we can't altogether face. I admit I haven't been able to face all of that either. It does seem, even though we're kind of breaking the taboo with this dialogue, still too horrible to contemplate. Mm. And yet manning up to actually turn to face what I can't face does express my character, you know, what I would hope my character can be.
Yeah. And I think for me also, what we were saying earlier about it comes down to the same work. It comes down to the same work for me in my own personal life. If anything, my dedication to my own inner exploration, meditation, other things has deepened and has become more important because of that, just my own practice as well as what I want to offer the world in my, you know, in what I give in my meditation and things. It's become, you know, as important for myself to be really exploring that more deeply, but not as, you know, a cop-out. You know, people say, oh, you know, it's that whole thing of meditation or activism and just going and studying your navel is a cop-out. I don't see that at all. I see it as how can I free myself from a lot of the, I just call it stuff, ego stuff, if you like, whatever it is that actually gets in my way of being what I can truly be. And that work becomes more important for me.
Yeah.
That way, you know, that's how I make a better contribution to whatever the future's going to be, whatever it's going to be.
Right. I mean, I think it's important to bring forward the fact that we both acknowledge that, you know, we do not know. We are not predicting this necessarily. What we're saying is that in this contemplation of the crisis, it tends to be made superficial by our inability to contemplate the worst case. And by including it, we're breaking a kind of agreed upon taboo that we all must be hopeful, because without being hopeful, we can't somehow bear to participate. And that kind of means that the spiritual depth of our affirmation of love and consciousness might be insufficient to survive some of the more extreme challenges that are possible among some of our possible scenarios. And by facing it, perhaps we can ground our consciousness and our practice and our commitment in something more radical and more durable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is a level of denial of this scenario, and it's about being real. I think, you know, so many times, you know, therapists and people say, you know, this denial that actually is holding us back, and just to be real about the different possibilities, as you say, I find it grounding as well.
And as we drop into a kind of sobriety, I've had some conversations with Andrew Harvey, who's a wonderful conversation partner, who is very willing to look at the more horrible potentials. And he argues that this utter upset that comes up has a spiritual function, that we need to go into what he would call the divine feminine and just be kind of, you know, horrified and grieve and rail and kind of go through those intense emotions and that those transform us too. That there may be different. Well, maybe some of us are different typologically. You know, Andrew's mm-hmm. a very emotional and dramatic personality, and you're a more cerebral personality. And you know, I'm kind of, I don't know, go both ways or something. that there may be though some psychic alchemy that can be worked in our intense upset and grief, and our the alchemy of working with this dread and horror, that it itself can be a part of the function and faculty through which we arrive at a deeper sobriety and clarity. What do you think of that?
I think so, yes. And again, as you're saying, you know, I come back to what happens to individuals when faced with their own mortality. There can be that initial horror and shock and, oh, my God. And then as people look at that and work with it, it can be a real source of wisdom and awakening. But it takes that working with it. It takes that letting it in, really letting it in. I think this is what Andrew's pointing to. You know, how whatever our context is, whether we're coming from, you know, his divine feminine approach or some other approach. But I think the letting it in is what's important. I mean, it comes back, reminds me of Jung's saying, which I think Werner Erhard popularized, but what you resist persists. And Jung was meaning in the sense of our shadow, the shadow, what we don't look at keeps us trapped. And I think there's a way in which that is true today, but what we don't look at in terms of future scenarios is actually in some way keeping us trapped.
Yeah. Now, as you arrive into this as just a friend to another soul, your resort is to the present moment and to consciousness. And in some of our conversations, you've shared with me a couple of very simple and highly distilled practices that express what your honest offering is, you know, in the midst mm-hmm. of your depth. And I wanted to give you a chance to share some of that right now.
Okay, thank you. One really comes out of my work with meditation. I think we make meditation much more difficult in our minds than it need to be. I see it as simply allowing the mind to relax. And as we let our mind relax, or rather let our attention relax, we just drop back into that own essential beingness, and which is what all the great teachers have pointed towards, whether you call it, you know, being the transcendent, the true self, whatever. They're all pointing to this quality that's always there. But because our attention is focused on getting things done, changing the world, having things be the right way, making sure we're safe out there, our attention is nearly always focused on the world. And we don't notice, if you sense that sense of I-ness, which is attending. We notice what we're attending to, but not the fact that this sense of being, the I-ness, that is attending. And what I've been just working with the last couple of years is realizing whenever our attention is on something we need to be doing, changing, resisting, hoping for, getting excited about, whatever it is, there's a slight constriction of consciousness that comes in. There's a slight tightening of the mind. Another way to put it is probably the negative. We're no longer totally at ease. If we're looking at how can we get something, hold on to it, something we're fearing, something we're needing, something we're excited about, the mind isn't just totally at rest, at peace. And you can begin to notice, I found this in meditation, you can begin to notice that sense of constriction or tension that's there. And it's almost the hallmark of the ego's way of thinking. The ego, I think of the ego as that way of thinking which is about getting the world to be the way we want it to be so that we can be happy. Whenever that is operating, there's this slight, it's very slight, but you can begin to notice it, this slight sense of tension and constriction. And so my practice and what I've been beginning to share with people in my own teaching is to just to notice that, not to try and change our thinking, not to try to control thoughts or whatever, or not to try to put our attention on, you know, something wonderful or a mantra or the breath or whatever it is, but just to become aware of that slight sense of constriction of consciousness that comes. And what I find time and time again is by bringing that sense of slight constriction into the light, by becoming aware of it, it begins to dissolve, and I just drop back spontaneously into that sense of beingness. And this has been really, really powerful for me. It's like there's, it's not so much as anywhere we're trying to get to in meditation, but it's like relaxing the attention so that we can just drop back into basically where we already are, but we're not noticing it because we're focused on the outside. And this just feels a very, very fundamental and very simple way of stepping out of the thinking mode, just dropping back into that, whatever we want to call it, our true self. So that's one thing I think.
It reminds me a little bit of my root guru's core inquiry, which was avoiding relationship. He would just ask because, you know, he noticed that ego was not really an entity but a present activity, which he called the self-contraction, kind of similarly. He would just, it was a kind of avoidance.
Yes.
He would just try to point attention to the present quality of avoiding.
Yes, yes. Yes, and again, I'm not saying this is something, wow, I've discovered something brand new that no other teacher has said, but it's something that I think, yes, many people have discovered and pointed towards it, and I've just found it, I've just been finding the power and the simplicity in it.
Yeah.
Is really important. And, I mean, my whole approach to teaching people meditation these days is to take away any sense of effort. We even unconsciously bring in a slight sense of trying or effort or even expectation. I mean, I sometimes joke, the worst thing, when someone one day has a wonderful meditation, they just drop into the silence or whatever it is for them, the compassion, the opening of the heart, and it's like, finally, I've got it. You can almost guarantee the next time they sit to meditate will be the opposite. And I think that's just because, you know, that finally I've got it becomes a like, and then you have the expectation the next time you sit down and there's that tiny bit of, I know where I'm going, and we're no longer completely innocent. And I think that dropping into it comes out of complete innocence, and having that wonderful experience destroys that complete innocence. And so there's that very slight wanting.
Yeah.
And I found for me, just whenever I notice any slight sense of wanting in meditation, and this happened to me a few years ago, the meditation was great, I was sitting there quiet, but it wasn't quite as deep as I sort of was used to. It was like I noticed that slight dissatisfaction and wanting, and I realized I was not including that in what was happening. When I just said, okay, what is right now is there's also this sense of wanting something better, something different, and realizing I was trying to work the meditation. When I just stopped and said, okay, that's part of what is. In this moment, there is this wanting something different, everything relaxed. And that's what it to me is about, is just allowing our attention, our minds to just relax.
Yeah.
It's so simple, but for me, I'm just finding it's so profound.
Yes, yes. And you've extended that into the domain of relations with another practice that we've talked about that I wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what I call love in action or caring in action. What I realized in a number of years ago is how easy it is for us to get into a cycle of really of attack between two people in relationship, whether it's, you know, a deep, intimate, personal relationship or somebody at work or whatever. And what can happen is that you may say something to me and you mean it out of, you know, it's completely clean, it's from the depth of your heart, but for some reason, you know, I've got my own baggage and I misinterpret what you say or something, and I feel slightly offended or slightly hurt or slightly criticized or slightly judged. And when I feel that way, if I'm not, you know, fully noticing what's happening, the automatic reaction to feeling slightly hurt is actually we try to hurt back. And so I might, you know, my tone of voice might change, my body language might change, or it might be more overt coming back to you with what I say. But now what's happening is I'm actually deliberately trying to hurt you a little bit. And now you feel that, and you feel, oh, you know, I'm slightly judged or offended or hurt. And, you know, we then get into a cycle of, and this is what's sort of sad and ironical at the same time, is two people wanting to be loved. I mean, I think, you know, deep, deep down, we all want to be loved. We want to love. None of us want to be judged, rejected, hurt. Two people wanting to be loved, sort of saying to each other, I'm just going to dig the knife in just a little bit and make you realize the error of your ways, and then you will love me better. And obviously, if you've got two people doing that, you just spiral downwards, and it gets worse and worse. And I realized the way out of that is, again, very simple, very powerful. And it came from something I heard the Buddha said. I say I heard because I don't know whether this was actually one of his teachings or not, but someone said, the Buddha said, if you can't say something in such a way that the other person feels good on hearing it, it's better to retain noble silence. And then added, until you've worked out how to say it. It's not a cop-out, like, I don't know how to say this to you, Terry, so I'm just going to back off and keep quiet. It's like, okay, I don't know how to say this in such a way that you are going to feel, you know, loved and respected, particularly if there's something, you know, there's something critical or something I'd like you to adjust. It then pulls it, okay, how can I say this? How can I behave in such a way that you don't feel attacked? And this is the key thing. It's like having the intention in any interaction, and you know, I've done this in partnership, and the results are magic. It's like you have the intention, whatever you do, you want to remove any sense of attack. It's like if you notice that coming up, just pausing and saying, okay, that's a slight attacking thought. How can I say this in such a way that the other person feels loved? And when you do this, it's like for me the experience is when you've got two people having this as an agreement, it's like a new quality of love that it begins to descend into the relationship. There's something, it's a sort of shared love. It's not so much me loving the other person more, the other person loving me more. There's a quality of love that begins to descend into the relationship. Because this is what we are doing. Loving each other is actually caring for the other person's well-being. And we can be fairly good at that, you know, in terms of caring for the other person's well-being. It's like, you know, I know you, you know, I know you're allergic to this food, let's do this, let's go to this restaurant, or, you know, I know you're, you know, suffering about this, or I know you really like to do this. We care for each other's sort of physical well-being. And this is really caring for each other's inner well-being, how they're actually feeling inside. And again, it's so simple. It's just that thing of monitoring one's own motivation. And when you notice there's an attack thought coming, just like reframing that. Or if you do, if it comes out, it happens at time, you blurt out something like, you stupid, whatever. May not be that strong. But just say, actually, sorry, that was coming from the wrong place. Let's just go back 10 seconds here and let me just, you know, take that back. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, this is what all the great teachings have talked about in one way or another. It's what's called the golden rule, which is basically treat others as you would like to be treated. And I suppose what I'm saying is, as well as treating others in the material world as we would like to be treated, it's like treating each other's being, each other's psyche, each other's mind, soul, whatever you want to call it, treating that in the same way that you would like to be treated, which is none of us really want to be judged, criticized, hurt emotionally. We all want to be loved and appreciated. So let's do that. Let's just, in everything we do, seek to have it come from a place of love rather than attack.
I love that. And I notice that I do often practice that. What comes forward for me as I contemplate this is how more and more I aspire toward an unlimited level of loving and of deepening in my consciousness. That in a sense, this larger contemplation of our world situation draws me to an unlimited commitment to grow in my capacity to be, well, you know, really saintly. Not that I am. I'm no saint. But my aspiration, my intention is really to be love in ever more authentic and deep and genuine and powerful and effective ways. And that adds this whole dimension to the koan. How can our love magnify itself? How can we be love together in ways that groups of us can be love so powerfully that we have bigger effects on the larger groups that we are parts of? And how can that ripple forward into the world more completely? How can I be love in the simplest little interactions that I have? And I know I've shared with you a practice that has become more and more alive for me, because very often I can understand how to do that practice of loving as you described it with the people I do know, but the clerk at the store or the neighbor I pass on the street, there's a way that I want to be loved even in those relationships more fully than I've yet known how to be. And for me, the simple expression of that does feel authentic is to just deepen in my capacity to rest with in the consciousness at the heart, and to resonate from the heart with the heart of every other person. Like right now, to notice the care, and you know, there's so much goodness expressed in your life's work and in the intelligence and consistency of your application to these big questions, and just there's an appreciation, an authentic appreciation that's resonating in my own being, and in these little chance encounters with people I don't really know, I can just intend that goodwill, and then make a little bit of eye contact, you know, not in a weird way that's intrusive and kind of the gazy, starey kind of a thing, but just to lean into the contact with the other person, maybe having just a split second more eye contact, all of it a vehicle for that heart resonance, not trying to get an acknowledgement, not looking to make it register as if I'm making a point that they should think about.
Right.
But really be just being a presence of this of this benign and caring and loving intention.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, as you say that, what comes up to me is like it's saying hello on a heart-to-heart level. And that just, it's small, but it just touches people. I know, you know, if you're walking down the street and you meet a stranger and you just, something happens, you make contact, you just say hello sometimes to a stranger. It's like, there's a meeting with somebody you don't know, and it doesn't mean anything, but it's just something, it just touches us. And I think what you're saying is like, the same thing. Just if your eyes just touch for a moment, it's just saying hello. That place of knowing, another being here.
Right. You know, that is what I mean. If there were some horrible news that we were going to die in just a few minutes, and somehow we were not able to change our circumstance, we would spend these last few minutes here on this audio link, just hearing each other's voices and being in this moment. I would only want to drop deeper into the tenderness and beauty of the present moment and in communion with you in a shared caring consciousness. I would only want to be life while life is, you know. I wouldn't want to let that last moment, you know, that last sunset be unacknowledged, you know, to enjoy even and to appreciate and celebrate and love what is the beginning point for being that which is healthy and can respond even to the most disorienting challenges, you know, from in a way that's both healthy and productive.
Yeah. And again, what we're talking about here is just what, you know, every tradition has come down to, the importance of that, of love. Or even as I say that, I'm reminded, you know, the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. To me, somehow, I think they represented, you know, a creative flash in cultural history. There was that moment. It's almost like they came to give that message and then they dissolved. And the message, it's like, it just resonated. Everybody, it resonated across the world, yes. And what was interesting, I mean, just as an aside, their recording of All You Need Is Love was the first global live satellite broadcast on Telstar. Mm-hmm. It went out with, you know, everybody in the studio, the Stones, everybody. But it's like, interesting, it was like actually a global collective broadcast. And there's the message, and I see, you know, in the 50 years since, what we've been doing is really working on how do we do that. You can have a creative flash, as we all know with creativity, you can have, that's the solution. Now begins the work of actually turning that solution into action. And I see that, in a way, that this is what our cultural journey has been about. It's like, that's the insight, which, again, not new, but like they expressed it so well, it captured the world. How do we do that? How do we actually turn that into action, manifest it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to go further with this, but it's time for us to invite questions. So if you've called in on your telephone, please press *2. And you can raise your hand and interact with us live. And a number of you have already typed in some really interesting questions. If you are listening on your computer, please notice there's a window where you can type in a question, and we will receive it. A couple of important announcements. First, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Peter's work. He's the author of 10 books and is best known to many for his book from the 80s, The Global Brain, in which he foresaw the internet and the impact it would have on humanity. His most recent book, From Science to God, is an exploration of the challenges modern science has with explaining consciousness. He proposes that we should accept consciousness as a fundamental quality of the cosmos. And in so doing, we begin to bridge the gulf between science and spirituality. He has a very rich website with hundreds of pages containing articles, audios, videos, and meditations. You can visit it at peterrussell.com. His most recent offering there is an online meditation course, How to Meditate Without Even Trying. In it, he shares various practices that help make meditation easy and effortless. That's peterrussell.com. I also want to let you know more about me and what I do. My work is dedicated to human transformation at all scales, focusing on both the inner and the outer work. You can find a rich body of articles, blog posts, audios, videos, events, and more, and connect with my mailing list at terrypatten.com, T-E-R-R-Y-P-A-T-T-E-N. I'll also be teaching in Cuernavaca, Mexico, this coming weekend, September 4th and 6th, and I'll be speaking in Montreal later this month and in Paris in early October. I'll also be co-leading the Integral Living Room event in October, November with Diane Mushel Hamilton, Jeff Salzman, and Ken Wilber. You can find out more about all these events at terrypatten.com and sign up for my mailing list. Now let's take a look at the questions. Remember, if you've called in on the phone, you can press star 2, or if you're listening online, you can type in your questions for Peter or me. Let's begin with a live question. This one is from Main Island, BC. At least the phone number is. We don't know your name, though. Please introduce yourself. You're on the air.
Hello, Terry. This is River Judd calling from Main Island, yes, out in the Gulf Islands. And I have, in the process of listening just now, come across a strange thing that happens to me. Every now and then, it could be 10 times a year, I look at somebody I'm passing on the street, or someone whom I'm in perhaps dire conflict with, or just the person I remember, and it's usually a person, and I suddenly think of the word love. Now this could be someone I'm really engaged in dispute with, perhaps, or just, you know, an unknown person, and I've never understood why. I suppose I have, from my meditation experiences, I'm connecting it to the what I am fairly much in the knowing of. I know this, that there is a great vast amount of my being that is not known to me, that is outside of my consciousness, that is not in my thoughts, but it's clearly there, and meditation reveals that clearly. There's stuff beyond our thoughts. And I'm just listening to Peter's talk, thinking, this love, and the all you need is love, and the largesse that is the giant everything behind our eyes that really is us, which we are not connected to, but which we all are as a single big entity, is the thing that will survive physical humanness should we all perish. And I'm my only reason for my reason for calling is to underline what you and Peter both have said, which is we can express that fullness even though we may not exist tomorrow. An important thing is to express that fullness even though we may not exist tomorrow. Our being is far beyond our physical existence here on the planet.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wondered if you wanted to comment on that, Peter.
I'm touched by it. I mean, one comment I would make is not to try to understand it, what's going on. I usually take the view, if I try to understand something, I'm probably going to come up with the wrong understanding anyway, so let's not bother. It's more, what does the actual experience mean? You know, things like that, I mean, I hear from what you're saying, it's like it touches you. And to notice that feeling of being touched, to savor the experience, to be with the experience rather than getting caught up in our minds of understanding it, to actually just... when that happens to you, just opening up to how it's actually feeling to be in that moment where you have that connection with somebody, and just to allow those moments into our being just more fully and more deeply.
Mm, thank you, Peter. I want to share a question that came to us from London, from George Poor.
George. I know George.
Yeah, so do I.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
It's the same George Poor, at least.
I don't think there are too many, yeah. He asked what potential we see in the collective sensing into the answer, not only by leading evolutionary philosophers or leaders or agents, but also by interconnected communities that are entering into higher intersubjective, higher we space together.
Mm. I think this is something which I think there's an intuitive knowing here we all have, that when we move into that collective space, something beyond our individual intentions can begin to manifest. I mean, time and time again, I'm asked this question in a different context in terms of group meditation. People say, why are group meditations so powerful? Why is my personal experience in meditation so much clearer, deeper, quieter when I'm doing it with other people? And the answer I have is, I don't know. But I know it happens. I know there's something going on here, and it's something to be trusted and valued. And I think it's the same with what George is pointing to in terms of our collective action of dropping our individual selves, but allowing those to take less focus and moving more into that collective space, what you're calling the we space. Well, I know, Terry, that's something you...
I'm very excited by what is happening there. I think it's one of the really fruitful frontiers of our investigation. And I think finding ways to deepen our levels of contact with one another and our awakeness, and letting the power of that intersubjective field magnify is this is something that a number of people, in fact, my next guest on this series, Patricia Albert, focuses on this exclusively, and something that Thomas Hubel, who I've worked with, focuses on quite a bit. It was a theme of Andrew Cohen's work, and it shows up in the work of Craig Hamilton and Jeff Carrera and Tom Steininger in Germany. It's a big factor in the work of Decker Kanov and Robert McNaughton. It's a very living thing. There's a new book coming out, edited by Olin Gunnlaugsson and Michael Brabant, on these different approaches to enlightened intersubjectivity, and it's something I've even been writing about. I think it's of tremendous importance. It's one of the things that I find most hopeful. It does seem to me to be one of the most enlightened forms of political engagement, like actually awakening as individuals and finding ways to be more awake together and being able to trust one another and be trustable in deeper ways is one of the frontiers of our evolutionary journey at this time. And it's something I'm intending to be doing in a small way, just in our dialogues, Peter. I think we've dropped in those levels of mutual respect and contact, we begin to create a space where each of us are invited to think new thoughts and find our way into new territory. And the catalytic quality of that contact is undeniable in my experience. Do you agree?
Yes. I'm sitting here nodding and realizing you can't see me nodding.
That's great. Wonderful. Well, let me take another live caller. This is someone calling on a cell phone with a 310 exchange. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Terry. It's Fred Cook calling you from Los Angeles.
Hello, Fred.
Thrilled that you guys are having this conversation, and appreciate being able to join you in it. I'd like to pick right up with what you were talking about before and say there is a recognized phenomenon that happens in Quaker meetings. It happens in a lot of situations where a group of people are listening deeply, and it enables an individual to dig more deeply into their own consciousness, to speak with more intelligence than perhaps is usual. And I think that's a fairly widely recognized phenomenon at this point. Tom Attlee has popularized it as co-intelligence, and he has a whole website and institute concerned with it.
Yeah,
beyond
you,
that,
Fred.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
was there something you wanted to go on to? Is there a question there?
Yes. The question of what do we do? How do we hold this problematique, as you say? Seems to me that there are some deep roots on which we can draw, and Gandhi's idea of satyagraha, holding firm to the truth, is one long tradition that I think we can draw upon. The way that Joanna Macy and the other people in InterHelp have worked with that, I think goes a step further and is, since the 80s, a community of practice in which people support each other to use a whole range of methods, including ritual, to confront the downside of what may be emerging. Are either of you familiar with that? Have you had contact with that? InterHelp.
I've had contact with Joanna Macy, I mean, over the years, and sat in some of her workshops when she was working a lot with the nuclear issue and these things. And I've been sort of sensing, I haven't seen her recently, but I've been sensing, you know, her approach of just really accepting, you know, the deep pain of the issues is, it's like, it's almost coming of age now. And I've always valued her work highly. And so, yeah, I think this is being called for even more.
Yeah, there are so many great traditions of deep work. Tom Attlee's work is terrific. Clearly the Quakers have been at it forever. Gandhi's an example. And yet there is a way in which all of these traditions of work are alive, and in this moment, drawing on them, learning from them as much as we can, our practice and our responsibility is to somehow bring all of this alive right now. And this opening into our pain over the terrible suffering, I mean, we have 60 million plus refugees in the world right now, many of them so desperate that they're risking and losing their lives trying to get into Europe or the United States. And those of us who are living in relative stability and comfort are beginning to realize that the emergency is now, and that our ability to be love is urgent in ways that we didn't understand before. And this is breaking our hearts. And I think that letting our hearts break in some way, deepening and coming together, you know, it's clearly these traditions of practice are reaching a kind of moment of truth for us all. This conversation reflects that, and you're helping connect us to this rich webs of practice that precede us. I don't know, Peter, are you finding yourself catalyzed as you think about Joanna's work that reconnects?
I think it's been in the back of my mind, yes. And maybe this conversation right now just pulls it forward.
Yeah.
And one thing, just listening to this, you know, as we've been taking this last question, something's been coming up, which I just want to share. I think it's important to say, is, you know, what we've been talking about here and I've been sharing is how I am and how it's affected me and my life and how I choose to live, whatever it is. We are all different. You know, some of us are called to be fervent activists on a certain issue. Others are called to, you know, do deep social work. Whatever it is, we're all called in different ways. And I just want to really say that I'm not saying this is what we should do as a collective or as other individuals. We are talking about how you and I are responding to this, which I think is really important. But I also want to just say that I'm not saying this is what we should do, but we each have to follow our own truth and follow what we're called for. I think that is the most important thing.
Yeah, and keep that alive so that it has an opportunity to develop and evolve. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are quite a few rich questions. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, obviously, but I want to ask a couple that are very personal. Nori Lee in Berkeley says, in contemplating possible end times, how do I psychologically deal with these fellows who are contributing so much to the possible end of it all, like the Koch brothers or Dick Cheney? How do I be charitable and caring? And then Suzanne in Scottsdale, Arizona asks, as I have become more and more able to let go of my desire for things to be how I want them, as I relax the desire of wanting, it is overflowing from my meditation time into my whole life, and somehow I'm experiencing this sometimes as apathy and inability to work toward anything other than loving. This is posing a problem. So those are kind of two questions from opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yes. Yes, and hi, Laurie. This is a difficult question. It's like I think we need to, in a way, separate two questions here. I mean, take, you know, Nori mentions the Koch brothers. We certainly may not like what they are doing. That's, again, an individual choice. Some people may feel they are our saviors. Whatever, we have our individual reactions as to their influence on the world or anybody else. We don't make it too personal on certain people. And we may want to, we feel inclined to change things, to not have that happen. And, you know, that may infuse us to do all we can in certain areas to change the world and say, no, this is not good. I do not want to see this happening. And here's how I can personally exert my bit of influence in the world to begin to change things and work with others to begin to change things. And then there's the other issue of the sort of the psychological judgment we make against other people, which is that somehow they are in themselves wrong or evil or bad. And I think that's where, in a way, that's where compassion can be a useful thing, to bring in some compassion here as to how come, what's going on with them? I mean, I think it's just, whenever we get angry with somebody, whenever there's anger, there's usually behind the anger is, they should not be doing this. I would not do this if I was in their position. I should not be doing this. And yet, if we were truly in their position, with everybody, with their background and whatever it is, and all they've been through in life and everything else, we would probably behave exactly the same way if we were truly them. So it's a sense of letting go of the anger reaction. We can have I'm just thinking of a conversation I had with another friend recently, and we were talking about the Holocaust but actually basic things which are happening in Germany now as well. And she would say, you know, how can you not feel anger at this? How can you not feel anger? And the other person in the conversation said, well, I can feel sadness. I can feel grief. I can feel these emotions, but I'm not sure that, you know, anger is an appropriate emotion here. So I think what I'm saying is there's two sides to this. This, do all we can to fight the behaviors, the actions we don't like, but also not to get caught up in the anger, the blame. But if there's a way of developing sense of compassion for understanding of how people could be doing this, if we can put ourselves in their shoes, then I think there can be an added freedom there. So that's a very long-winded answer.
Yeah. You know, there are so many rich questions. I hope we can go a little beyond the 90 minutes to at least get a few more of them. One of them that I think is very significant, Stephen in Kilauea on Kauai, asks that he's noticing anthropogenic climate change is so rarely in daily conversations, even though it appears to me is the most important issue that needs our attention. Can you say more about why collectively we seem unable to face the dark possibilities of the future? And I would go further to say I've recently been corresponding with Michael Dowd, who's going to the World Parliament of Religions that's going to be taking place in another just a few weeks in Salt Lake City with a statement that he hopes that the World Parliament will take up, which will join with what Pope Francis has said in his encyclical, so that there's a moral call for dealing with climate change on the part of all the world's religions in a formal way, because that moral call really kind of, it is, doesn't seem like scientists can stand in that moral space in the same way that perhaps religious leaders can, which feels like a very positive thing. And so there is a role that we have in this world that does seem in some ways to be sleepwalking into some pretty critical situations, to be clarion calls for that waking up. And yet, if we engage those processes in the wrong spirit, we seem only to contribute to the babble of argument that is sort of becoming a dissonance that's only separating people from one another. And I wonder what your reflections are on how to do that outer work of helping us wake up.
You mean how to bring those sorts of realities into our daily consciousness more?
Yes, both in on a human scale and on a larger social scale. I mean, you've certainly done a lot in your own way by writing your books and giving talks all over the world. But is there something you've learned in that about the skillful means of doing that effectively, even though obviously as a species, denial is pretty darn persistent?
Yes. And denial is, it's like we don't want to go there. There's a way in which we don't want to look at it. There's a way in which I found at times useful, just sometimes called sort of the Aikido conversation. Instead of trying to, you know, in conversations with people about things, rather than trying to force one's own view on top of them, say, hey, look, this is what's happening, you've got to think about it, or whatever it is, this is what's real. It's almost like the coming in gently from behind, and almost like seeing what are their views, how are they seeing things, and then to gently work with how they are seeing things to maybe bend them into a different way of seeing. I'm saying this with in conversations where I'm having with people who may be, actually, I have one friend who's a climate denier. It's very, very interesting. He's one of the great staunch deniers of climate change. But, you know, gradually he's coming round, and it's just by this way of not just, he's always quoting facts at me and things, and just to gently come in from behind with him and like steering him the other way. That's why I call it sort of the Aikido conversation. You work with their energy. But that's on a sort of a one-to-one basis. I think, not, you know, speaking our own truth, sharing our truth, keeping it in the forefront without, as we've been saying, you were saying earlier, Terry, about not getting preoccupied with it and just totally wrapped up in, oh my God, what's going to happen? But allowing it to be in our consciousness, not pushing it away. And that's the denial. It's the pushing things to the back, not looking at it. So I think it's the Yeah, it's really the undoing of the denial, of actually the acceptance of what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, the sharing of that with others. But in wise, skillful ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you. Let's take one more live call from Susan in Washington or Maryland. Hi, Susan. Please introduce yourself. Hello. Okay. She's not there. Let's go to several of these questions. Well, here's an interesting, there's a couple of questions I want to take. A fellow in San Francisco is pointing out that questions like how can I free myself up from all this ego stuff or how can I be loved to others are putting the cart before the horse. Because he thinks that realizing your primordial condition in consciousness is the point, because the seeker cannot do these things, because by definition the seeker is living in illusion, and consciousness tells us I am everywhere and everything, and this tells me the seeker is a configuration of consciousness that doesn't know that he is. And that's why he's trying to enter a condition that he's already in. That's the illusion in a nutshell. So it seems to me that consciousness and not the seeker is the only one who can free the seeker and open to love. What about that?
This is a fascinating question, and it comes up again and again. It's part of the paradox of this spiritual path is, it is about, this question says, the primordial consciousness of just of recognizing that, of being that. And the seeker is part of the ego structure. And yet it can be, in this sense, I think it can actually be a healthy part of the ego structure. It's like this part of the ego structure says, I see that my actions, my behavior, I'm causing myself pain and suffering, and maybe by meditating I can reach a state where I'm suffering less and feeling better. So it's a great, it's an ego motivation, but it's actually turning the attention into that direction. And there comes a moment for people on the path where there is that recognition that it is actually the seeking that is getting in the way. I mean, one of my little sayings, aphorisms, is seek and ye shall not find, because the very act of seeking is actually taking the attention somewhere else than its source. And yet through that exploration, there can come the undoing of the seeking and the recognition that it is the seeking itself that is in the way. And I've noticed this in my own practice. It's like when I notice, it's what I was saying, example earlier about wanting the meditation to be a certain way, when I notice this, the seeking is just to step back and let it go, to no longer be involved in it. It's the whole thing, people say there is no path, and yet there is a path to finding there is no path.
Yeah.
As another teacher said, the purpose of all techniques is to realize no technique is needed.
Yeah. This is I feel very sufficient answer to that question. Thank you. There are so many good questions here. Let me ask this one from Christine in Graz, Austria. If people in the world would become more aware of their hidden fears and there were ways to transform them effectively, we could avoid a lot of dramas. Thomas Hubel was recently quoting the Tao Te Ching in a seminar, put things in order before they exist. I love this, and I know by experience that we can. Awakening is the key. My question for you is, can you tell me a way to transform irrational existential fear saved in our bodily structure? I mean, fear in the intensity of panic. I'm convinced that we carry so much traumatic experience in our systems that force us to repeat wars and losses and famines and disease and conflicts and so on, which could be prevented if we could actually drop down and become aware of the unconscious fear that we're carrying in our bodies.
Mm. Yes, definitely. And this, of course, is, you know, the goal or the path of so many different types of therapy in one way or another, this recognition that it is our fears, the effect they have on us, and in one way or another, finding ways to dissolve them or let them go, whether it's going back into seeing their origins in some trauma or experiencing the actual feeling of the fear as it manifests, or digging into, you know, somatic, what's happening actually in the body, how it's locked into the body. I think this is a almost universal quest, and there are so many ways of going about it. But yes, the more we can uncover the fears that control us and find ways to either dissolve them or, in some cases, live with them in a healthy way. I don't think necessarily we're going to get rid of them always, but sometimes it's a question of really seeing what's there and relating to it in a different way so that it doesn't actually run our lives. But yes, I think this is what this call is saying is absolutely
crucial. This is something I think we can deepen into even right now just by asking this question and turning to face a horror that terrifies us. We have to encounter a certain bodily-based trauma. And there is a kind of courage that it has taken for me to begin to face this. And I don't pretend that I've fully faced it or that I'm done with that process, but this is done not only through somatic therapies, but even through our way of considering things philosophically and interpersonally. And I think our interpersonal work in this higher we space is another way that we enter into this too, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Peter, is there anything more you'd like to say as we complete? I want to apologize to several of you who asked terrific questions I would really love to ask, but I don't want to violate our time too horribly. Peter, what would you like to say to complete?
Strangely enough, I have nothing. I feel complete. I feel complete. There's nothing that's bubbling away, or we should have said this or touched on this, or I want to add this. I'm actually for once feeling complete.
Well, beautiful. Well, I want to thank everybody for arriving here for this dialogue, and I want to let you know that on September 20th, I'll be interviewing Patricia Albert. You can find out more about Peter's work, including his course, How to Meditate Without Even Trying, at peterrussell.com. You're invited to go to terrypatton.com and sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter and find out about my upcoming events. And if you appreciate what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. Thank you so much for joining Peter and me today. And thank you, Peter. This has been a rich conversation, and I hope it serves everyone who hears it.
Yes. Well, thank you, Terry. I know this came out of our own conversations and your suggestion of why don't we actually talk about this publicly. So thank you for making this opportunity available.
Yeah. Great. Goodbye, everyone.
Hello.